This is JAMDA On The Go, your review of the content featured in JAMDA, the research-focused monthly journal of AMDA, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now, here is your host for JAMDA On The Go, Dr. Wayne Saltzman.
Welcome to JAMDA On The Go. This podcast will spotlight articles from the November 2020 issue of JAMDA, the Journal of the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. We will be speaking with JAMDA co-editor-in-chief, Dr. Philip Sloan, and associate editor, Dr. Mallory Brown. Dr. Sloan is a family physician and geriatrician with a master's degree in public health. He is the Elizabeth and Oscar Goodwin Distinguished Professor of Family Medicine and Geriatrics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and co-director for the Program on Aging, Disability, and Long-Term Care at the Cecil G. Shepp Center for Health Services Research. Dr. Brown is also a family physician and geriatrician at the University of North Carolina, where she is an associate professor of family medicine and director of the residency training program. Today's topics on JAMDA On The Go include COVID-19 testing and case management in post-acute and long-term care, modifiable risk factors for dementia, and the effects of a humanoid companion robot on persons with dementia. So I see that our first paper, Dr. Sloan, is co-authored by four members of the AMDA's Infection Committee and includes the current society president. You know, just seeing their names focused my attention immediately, as they are some of the greatest thought leaders within AMDA today. What do they have to say about our time in the pandemic of COVID-19?
Well, as much of a leadership team as they are, they also managed to find time to write a decent paper. It's actually very good. It's entitled, "Does Universal Testing for COVID-19 Work for Everyone?" But it's really, frankly, that one of the most authoritative long-term care relevant articles that I've been able to see around COVID testing. The first thing they do is they talk about the available tests. And we all know this. There are three general types of tests. There's a PCR nucleic acid test, the rapid antigen test, and the antibody test. The PCR test, it's the gold standard to determine whether or not someone is infected. It came out first, it's more widely available. It still can take a while to get back, unfortunately. It involves a nasopharyngeal swab, and then it's analyzed in a laboratory. It's more specific than sensitive, with a specificity of greater than 98%, and a sensitivity of between 70 and 95%. This means it's good as a confirmatory test or a diagnostic test, but not so good as a screening test. And explains why two tests a week or so apart are needed to reasonably definitively pronounce someone COVID-free. The antigen test requires a nasal swab just as much, but it detects a surface marker that has an even lower sensitivity, but it has the advantage of providing a result within minutes and being less costly than the PCR test. The third test, it's the antibody test. It's a blood test. You know, it's like we do for hepatitis exposure. It detects IgG and or IgM, typically IgM antibodies to the virus in the blood. It therefore documents past exposure, or soon, I hope, it will document successful seroconversion after a vaccine. Now it's sometimes used to determine if a person who's had the disease may return to work. What is unknown is how long antibodies persist and whether their presence confers true immunity. However, studies of persons with the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, another kind of coronavirus called the MERS, they're very encouraging. It's very similar to COVID, and these have indicated that in that disease, antibodies persist for many years, and persons who have recovered are not at risk for reinfection. We should be so lucky. One thing the authors point out is that all tests are relatively new and released without the same degree of research and documentation that is available for the tests we typically use.
Right.
And for that reason, yeah, things such as sensitivity and specificity are less precise and less well known.
Yes, absolutely.
The paper recommends that as soon as one case of COVID-19 is diagnosed, whether a staff member, resident, everyone, staff and residents should be tested. This is because the rate of asymptomatic COVID-19 is quite high. It's estimated that 50 to 80% of people never get symptoms. Now, it's probably less for older people, but we don't really know. In addition, even in people who become sick, there's a period where they're pre-symptomatic. You know, in the flu, it's like 1 to 2 days. But in COVID, it's like 4 to 5 days before they're shedding the virus, but they're not sick. So all these things mean that testing is necessary to pick up asymptomatic and pre-symptomatic cases.
Right.
So the article goes on to talk about cohorting strategies, but I'll save that discussion for the next paper, which describes it in more detail. The last thing I want to talk about is they talk about what nursing homes should do long-term, which is kind of where we're at now. And they recommend that a nursing home experiencing an outbreak should repeat tests every 3 to 7 days on everybody.
Wow.
But they note that a policy toward admissions, you know, should stratify new admissions based on the degree of certainty regarding whether or not they have COVID. You know, new admission comes in, if they've been documented to have the disease, whether they come from the hospital or have been quarantined in the nursing home, the criteria for considering a person no longer contagious is 10 days after symptom onset and over 24 hours without fever and with improved symptoms. Now, I was kind of disappointed they did not address the thorny topic of who and how often to routinely test for the illness when you don't have an outbreak going on. They note that for a typical nursing home, conducting weekly surveillance would cost at least $25,000 per month. They recommend submitting claims to each resident's primary insurer. But this is just an outrageous bookkeeping chore. They also point out that after the first nasopharyngeal swab, some residents will just refuse to have another one done. All of which leaves the reader with the realization that even these experts are struggling with determining what is the best way to proceed in the long run.
Yeah, you know, Dr. Sloan, I have to tell you that I am, I just continue to be amazed at the work our society's Infection Advisory Committee has done since the beginning, you know, going back to March of this year to help us understand and manage the impact of COVID-19 in post-acute long-term care. You know, they have continued to evolve in their assessment and management strategies along the way. And oftentimes they have stayed ahead of CMS and CDC discussions and recommendations. You know, I'm just so fortunate we're so fortunate to really have their leadership and understanding this illness in the post-acute long-term care setting.
I would just echo that. That group has been incredible. You know, the things that they've done and that the information we've gotten has been so disparate and it's changed so much.
Well, kudos to JAMDA as well. And in fact, this next paper that we're asking you to discuss is not just talking about, you know, COVID, but, you know, about another strategy of care during this pandemic in the skilled setting. You know, a multi-tiered cohorting strategy to facilitate the control of a serious COVID-19, you know, outbreak, you know, as distinguished from what we do for influenza or multi-drug resistant organisms. But I see that this paper is headed by the term pragmatic innovation. Is this a new format? Tell us how you identify an article under this classification and its potential for impact to the reader.
Well, thanks for asking. You know, this is a new type of article that the editors introduced a year or two ago. We haven't gotten that many submissions and we're happy to see more, you know. The papers are short and simple. The goal of this type of article is to give people in practice the chance to publish about a novel approach, technique, or way of doing things without needing all the statistical bells and whistles of a research paper. So in part, I wanted to share this study to point out that we have this pragmatic innovation submissions category. So listeners who have a novel thing they've created that they think might be helpful to others should know this option exists. Now, we don't want your actual novel. We don't want your kitchen recipe or anything else that's, you know, that you're really proud of, you know. Well, actually, if it's a recipe, you know, you can send it to the editors by email. You know, we really want, you know, things that work in the nurse, post-acute and long-term care setting. But this particular study does not involve just a community nursing home. It involves some academics from the University of Chicago. But it's about a partnership between hospital-based geriatricians and a multi-floor, it's kind of one of those high-rise urban community nursing homes. And it was having what sounds like a horrendous COVID-19 outbreak and how they worked to get the outbreak under control. The partnership implemented an organized strategy that involved these things. First of all, they PCR tested all 120 facility residents in one day. The academic side of the partnership arranged for a team of 10 university medical center nurses to come all at once to the nursing home. They obtained 60 nasal swabs per hour and finished the job in less than, you know, 3 hours. A second swab was conducted a week later by facility staff on all residents who had been initially negative, which was not that many, unfortunately. Here's how bad it was. The initial point prevalence testing that they did with all those nurses identified 43 negative persons and 77 positive residents in this nursing home.
Wow,
yeah. And so I mean, I just can't imagine what it was like. Not that many were that sick. But they established two cohorts. Two floors in this high rise, you know, were designated COVID positive floors, or what they call them, red wards, where sharing rooms was permitted. They were already sick. They weren't worried about giving it to each other. One floor was designated COVID-19 negative. It was called the, but likely exposure, since there was all this COVID around. So they call it the yellow ward. And everyone there was placed in their own room to reduce the potential for cross-contamination. They also had a memory floor, and they separated into two units with storm doors dividing positive and negative exposed cohorts. So basically they had two groups. They had a red group and a yellow group. At the end of 14 days and following the second point prevalence test, you know, a week later, a third or green cohort was established. Residents with two negative tests or a negative initial test and 14 days without symptoms were removed to the additional area, which was designated the green ward. Of course, they also implemented enhanced infection control practices. They assigned staff to only one cohort. They provided full PPE and respiratory precautions as appropriate, depending on the setting. So very interesting what they did, you know. There are several take-home points, I think, from this paper. The first is, with an outbreak, it's helpful to act fast. And that's where we really got behind the eight ball early in this epidemic. A partnership with a hospital or health system really helps make this happen. Theoretically, health departments should be helpful here, but they rarely, if ever, have seemed to have the resources to do the kind of rapid response that the academic hospital did. Also, you know, health departments do not typically have geriatricians. They didn't really understand this population. The second point is it demonstrated, as we've proven again over and over, that there's a lot of people with asymptomatic COVID-19 infections and that the incubation period is rather long. It's from 2 to 14 days, average of 5 days. This is the reason it was so useful to separate patients into positive, you know, not yet proven negative, that's the yellow group, and the true negative or green group. Now, what was not adequately expressed in this paper was how they dealt with staff. They said they did not test all staff members, and I think that was a bad idea. Instead, they focused on providing adequate PPE, screening for symptoms, maintaining assignments within specific wards. And apparently, they did a pretty good job, but frankly, I would think that staff testing should have been part of the protocol. And I did not review the paper, so I did not have the opportunity to ask the authors how things went with the staff. But still, I think, you know, as we really retool our infection outbreak protocols for whatever's going to happen after COVID-19, we've got to think about things like this.
So two things resonated with me from your discussion. The one was partnering with a hospital. I just fear that so many of these facilities are just kind of left out to dry, and realizing that we are all in this together and transitions of care are really mandates that we work together. I wholly endorse the idea of being able to partner with an institution. In addition, I am actually an elected member of our town's Board of Health, and I'm the medical director. I'm actually the medical director for the town. While we don't have skilled nursing facilities in our town, we do have 3 assisted living facilities. Mm-hmm. So once again, I do what you've said highly resonates, because I have been able to play somewhat of a valuable role in helping to understand how we can help maintain the wellness of our folks in these facilities through the Board of Health. And for our listeners out there, I would just urge, if you have the ability and the time, to seek out your Board of Health and see if you can be of assistance in helping to spread the message. And these Boards of Health, I have to tell you, they are working so hard in their towns to try to maintain control and a good status of health. Kudos, Dr. Sloan, for kind of mentioning those concerns.
So I got a question. Does that mean the Board of Health is the board for the health department?
So the Massachusetts, in this case, Department of Public Health, has its regulations and statutes, which the boards of health in Massachusetts carry out at the municipal level. May not be the same for all states, but it definitely is for ours, and we definitely play a role.
I'm sorry, with COVID the way it is, the more we can be involved at the local level with informing and helping educate, the better.
You're here. You're here.
Managing your patient's needs across multiple specialties is increasingly important, but also an increasingly challenging task. U.S. Post-Acute Care now offers clinical staffing solutions not only for primary care medicine, but also for behavioral health, chronic care management, and telehealth, bringing you a more comprehensive solution for your patients and your facilities. Now more than ever, your patients need you in so many ways. Let U.S. Post-Acute Care help you deliver more complete, quality care. For more information, visit us at uspostacutecare.com.
So let's change direction somewhat and talk about some other very valuable articles out of the November 2020 issue of JAMDA. Dr. Brown, the next article we're discussing, contributions of modifiable risk factors to dementia incidence, comes to us as a combined effort from multiple provinces in China. At first glance, it seems kind of intimidating, with network meta-analyses, Bayesian frameworks, and observational studies. But I know that you're going to be able to break it down for us.
I agree, Wayne. There are some certainly intimidating components of this. But at the end of the article, I think that it's some interesting and really good work. It particularly interested me because, as we've discussed in previous JAMDA on the Go podcasts, we as geriatricians are so often asked, how can I prevent dementia? And with excellent reason. We know dementia affects at least 5% of our population over the age of 65. It imposes a tremendous burden on both an individual's family as well as our society overall. And as we age, we're all looking for ways to maintain control over our day-to-day, so anything that can be done to maintain cognition seems like a pretty great idea. I was interested in what this article felt that might be. Because of current lack of powerful disease-modifying therapies and the complexity of various pathologies which lead to dementia, the authors felt that primary preventive strategies must be developed to relieve the global burden of dementia, and therefore looked into this a little bit closer. They also made the point to state that accumulating evidence has identified some modifiable risk factors in older adults who were possibly in prodromal stages of dementia that might be potentially easily measurable predictors of an increased risk. Over the past few decades, these modifiable factors, including an individual's socioeconomic and behavioral characteristics, as well as dietary intake, have been reported to affect changes in cognitive ability and the incidence of cognitive impairment, all-cause dementia and Alzheimer's dementia over time. This study really set out to compare the contributions of modifiable risk factors with the prevention of dementia in older adults. Using an exhaustive and comprehensive list search strategy to identify relevant studies, a systemic review and Bayesian network meta-analysis were completed. That meta-analysis, based on 43 cohort studies, concluded that sleep disturbance, education, diabetes, obesity, smoking, solitude, physical exercise, alcohol, and hypertension were associated with the incidence of dementia, but no association was observed between antioxidant use and the incidence of dementia. What they found is that sleep disturbance and education had the highest probability of exerting the greatest effect on reducing the incidence of dementia, indicating that there might play a relatively more significant role in an individual's life than other independent risk factors. I think it was last month that we talked a bit about the fact that sleep disturbance is a major issue for older adults and only worsens with age. Not getting adequate rest worsens inflammation in the brain and can lead, they believe, to dementia. Stressing the importance of rest and avoiding sleep disturbance is incredibly important, and I think really exemplified by this study. Robust evidence has also existed for education attainment. So higher education attainment may allow individuals to maintain a healthy lifestyle and prevent cognitive deficits as they age. For better or worse, using antioxidants seemingly had no effect on dementia development. So sleep disturbance, education, diabetes, obesity, smoking, being alone, physical exercise, alcohol use, and hypertension all possibly are independently associated with the risk of cognitive decline and the incidence of dementia. Sleep disturbance might be the most significant risk factor for cognitive decline in older adults. I thought this was an interesting read, and it gave me some additional information certainly to share with patients as they're asking what they can do. These are already all things I'm certainly treating, but it's a little more emphasis on why it's so important in preventing cognitive impairment down the road.
Yeah, you know, you can definitely appreciate the inflammatory, you know, impact of a lot of these risk factors. It kind of just makes sense, and we've had the discussion before, but, you know, I am again drawn to the sleep disturbance issue, and yes, we've already talked about the sleep patterns that change over time with regard to older adults. And it's something that as geriatricians, you know, we are taught to understand and appreciate. And I don't mean to put you on the spot, Dr. Brown, but, you know, how do we educate our colleagues to also be cognizant of sleep disturbance issues in older adults?
Well, I think for me, it's just a matter of normalizing the fact that we don't sleep quite as contently overnight most of the time as we age. And so normalizing that with my patients and being sure to teach my residents, the learners that work underneath me, that naps are okay as we age, and really just talking about sleep so that patients aren't as frustrated about it, because it is frustrating to not go to bed and wake up 8 hours later like you might have been used to. But really counseling patients on ways to get adequate rest is just so important.
And you've heard it here on Jamda on the Go. Dr. Mallory Brown says naps are okay. So our last paper for discussion, Effects of a Humanoid Companion Robot on Dementia Symptoms and Caregiver Distress, for residents in long-term care, comes out of Hong Kong. So another international submission from JAMDA to enjoy. And frankly, it's kind of fun. It's about a pumpkin-suited humanoid robot that resembles sounds and motions like a three-year-old boy. And so, you know, we know that these robots are being used as non-pharmacological interventions with for people with the syndrome of dementia. And it sounds really cool. Did you think the same after you reviewed the article?
It is. It's a really cool idea. I love seeing what folks are doing across the world in long-term care. This was just a really fun read for me. Specifically, this study tested the effect, as she said, of deploying a humanoid companion robot compared with usual care of residents in long-term care facilities with dementia. The investigators start this article by pointing out that 90% of long-term care residents with dementia will have at least one neuropsychiatric symptom during the course of their illness. These symptoms are obviously distressing to the patient and their caregivers, and the first-line treatment is non-pharmacologic and pharmacologic treatments, and companion robots have gotten a lot of attention over recent years as one of those potential non-pharmacologic interventions. Systemic reviews have indicated promising effects of companion robots in reducing agitation, decreasing loneliness, encouraging social interaction among residents with dementia, and decreasing distress for caregivers. In this randomized control trial over a period of about 32 weeks, a control group received usual standardized care in their long-term care setting, while a companion robot was introduced for 8-week periods to the care approach for an experimental group of participants. Outcomes were assessed at 5 different time periods, at the baseline, then at 8 weeks, 16 weeks, 24, and 32 weeks. Primary outcomes were assessed with the Neuropsychiatry Inventory Questionnaire, as well as the Geriatric Depression Scale. They also assessed secondary outcomes, and these were measured with the Hong Kong Montreal Cognitive Assessment, the Modified Barthel Index for ADLs, and the Quality of Life Alzheimer's Disease Scale. I was hoping for a bit more positive outcomes, but the sample size was fairly small. But the study did not observe a significant decrease in those neuropsychiatric symptoms when the humanoid robot was first introduced in weeks 8 to 16. But they did see that some of those same neuropsychiatric symptoms became more severe compared with the control group when that robot was taken away. So the study believes that this indicates that the humanoid robot may have a promising effect on dementia-related symptoms by reducing stress and agitation and providing comfort. The study found no significant improvement in cognitive function or quality of life for the residents with dementia, which is consistent with prior work and to me seems fairly intuitive for the populations of residents with severe dementia that they were examining this with. While an individualized care plan with continuous monitoring is required to integrate a humanoid robot, there may be potential in utilizing this type of companion in future dementia care, which is really exciting.
Yeah, I mean, I love the idea of individualizing care. I mean, we know that our patients who have dementia, they're all different. They all have nuances. Their life experiences are modifying, you know, how they are in the world with the illness. And the standardized therapies may not work. You know what I would have been interested to see? I would have been interested to see if there were differences in having the robot, having just a doll that perhaps even looked like the robot, and then you know, as a control or as another group, because you know, as we know, we often give dolls to our older adults who have who are experiencing behavioral symptoms from dementia, and just the doll alone, the idea of caring for a doll has created benefits. I would have loved to have seen if they found that distinction as well.
Yeah, that would have been interesting.
So even in the presence of the COVID-19 pandemic, JAMDA continues to focus on work around the world that may improve the care of our members and our ability to care for them in the post-acute and long-term care setting. And under the leadership of co-editors-in-chief Drs. Philip Sloan and Cheryl Zimmerman, and with the support of editors like Dr. Mallory Brown, the Journal of the American Medical Directors Association continues to be an impactful resource in post-acute and long-term care and beyond. Take a look at the November 2020 issue. Drs. Sloan and Brown, thank you again for spending your time with JAMDA On The Go.
Thank you so much, Wayne.
References for this podcast can be found at www.jamda.com. Until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for JAMDA On The Go.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post Acute Care. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, go to our new learning management system at apex.paltc.org. Click on podcast and follow the link to this latest episode. Thank you.